She's somebody who doesn't sort of respect those divisions of or those hierarchies of design, of fine art. You know, she doesn't give them so much reverence.
How to balance work, life, family. I think they're kind of age-old concerns.
I don't want to use a language that really segregates people. I don't want to use a language that makes them think about gender if they're looking at a female artist or a male artist.
Welcome to Sculpting Lives, a podcast with me, Sarah Turner.
And me, Jo Baring.
Today, we're going to be talking to the artist Rana Begum. I kind of hesitate trying to describe her there because she is someone who works kind of across disciplines. She's worked with sculptural materials, she's worked with baskets, with the kind of reflectors that you find on the back of your car.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that you stumbled almost over calling her a sculptor because I think she does not want to be defined by being simply a sculptor. As you say, she crosses disciplines, doesn't she?
But she did agree to come on a podcast called Sculpting Lives.
She
so
did.
Sculpture is a really big part of her thinking process, I think, and working through what objects can be in the world.
That's right. So she moves across disciplines like painting, architecture, design. She even makes furniture, doesn't she, Sarah?
She does, and she uses colour as a form and a formal language in its own right. It kind of has a life of its own in Rana's work. So we went to see her at her current studio in Haringey in North London, where there was lots of fabrication in process. She's got lots of big projects coming up in 2020. And in that space of work, we talked to her about her trajectory, actually, coming to Britain from Bangladesh as a young girl.
Yes, she's quite young. She's born in 1977 and came from Bangladesh to Britain. Aged about 8, I think.
Yeah, and then she trained at various art schools in Hertfordshire, at the University of Hertfordshire. She also attended the Slade from 1999 to 2002, where Tess Jarry was an artist who was really influential on Rana's career and still is. They're great friends. And then we kind of talked about her trajectory, how she became an artist, how she maintained a career as an artist and the challenges that she's faced in doing that and also the possibilities that have opened up.
I chose to do painting for my BA and MA because I found both of those kind of disciplines kind of be quite open and it meant that it was also open for collaboration as well. So I really, you know, I really wanted to kind of continue that.
What the collaborative kind of element, is that kind of something that has kind of stayed with you as you've...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know how at that time. I knew that I was interested in architecture, I was interested in design, I was interested in textile, I was interested in the different kind of medium as well. And I wanted to keep my options open.
I was thinking, actually, well, maybe you don't think of yourself as a sculptor. Yeah. Would you kind of self-define in that way? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult and it's not really me that has... that needs it. I don't need that definition at all. In fact, I'm much better without it. I kind of say, you know, I'm a visual artist, and I feel that's enough. But then people kind of need to kind of pigeonhole you in something. And usually when that is, then I kind of say, well, my work kind of between painting, sculpture and architecture. And I think I struggle with just being, you know, boxed in one discipline. I don't find it informs that experience. It kind of it just limits the experience, I feel.
So we're kind of sat in your studio.
Yes.
Can you just tell us a bit more about this space and sort of how you begin an idea or work? Because there's kind of models and there's ideas and
I currently have my studio in Haringey, which is has gone through various kind of usage, and it's been kind of a nursery to storage space to a garage to people actually living in it. I love this studio. It's fantastic. It's got two floors, and it means that I can really kind of one, be quite efficient in the studio and kind of separate certain aspects of it, you know, have the messy workshop downstairs and have clean space upstairs. And because I really like to produce a lot of my work in-house, and, you know, which means from beginning to the end. You know, there are kind of parts of the work that gets sent out and someone else will have to do. But most of the time, if we can, I'd like to do it in the studio. So that you need to have kind of certain spaces, you know, you need to have like perfect clean space, and you need to have kind of, you know, space where you can make, create dust and things. So, I mean, a lot of the time, you know, the way an idea would start would be, you know, if I'm working for a proposal for something, and usually I tend to kind of look at the space, look at the way the space works, you know, how people kind of function in the space. And the other kind of major element or factor in the way that I make the work or the way the ideas come up is natural light, how much natural light comes into a space and how that affects the space.
So is light a kind of another material for
you? Yeah, it is. And it really determines the kind of material I then go to use to describe or to conceive an idea.
One of the issues all artists face as they get busier and more successful is having the time to make their work. There's just so many demands as you do more exhibitions or are asked to give talks, you sometimes are teaching. And so an artist residency program is often a really crucial moment in an artist's career for developing an idea or an exhibition project.
That's right. So they're able to go to an institution or a studio and just take some time to think and maybe, you know, work through some ideas, some projects that they hadn't had time to think through formally before. Rana spent some time in 2018 at Tate St Ives. So there are some very historic studios in St Ives called the Porthmere Studios. So quite a lot of the very famous St Ives artists, like people like Ben Nicholson, have their studios
Wilhelmina
there.
Yeah, Wilhelmina Barnes Graham.
That's right. So they have these incredible windows that look out onto the beach and onto the sea.
It's probably quite distracting because there's lots of kids having their
bucket and spade holidays,
doing their surf lessons and things like that. So you do have some kind of competing distractions.
So as a result of that residency, Rana had an exhibition at Tate St Ives, didn't she? And we went down there to speak to Anne Barlow.
Yeah, Anne Barlow is the director of Tate St Ives, and Anne's worked with Rana quite closely. So she spoke to us about how she perceives Rana's career developing and some of the things that really interest her about the way that Rana works with colour and with form.
She spans sculpture, painting and architecture, and how she can move easily between creating more intimate work, such as those that she's exhibited in, you know, gallery and museum spaces, and major commissions like the one she did recently in King's Cross, number 700 reflectors. And in that sense, I think she sometimes makes me think of Barbara Hepworth, even though they're very different, in the way in which she can move quite easily and very skillfully between these different degrees and different scales in her work, from very intimate and private to very public in scale and scope. She works with materials that sculptors have used for decades, or for, in some cases, centuries. You could have like plaster, for example, but she also works with powder-coated aluminium or other kinds of metal that she has been inspired to use by looking at industrial sites or architecture, urban architecture, and then create something incredibly different with those objects. You know, so it's about seeing different patterns, different geometries, and different perhaps inherent structures in a material or in a form that she then adapts to and makes into something else. I think in terms of sculpture more broadly, there are so many strands, obviously, that have existed from modernism onwards, you know, from the solid form to the pierced form to the stringed form to the open form to installation and mixed media that incorporates photography and video. I think there's, in a way, no one easy definition of sculpture anymore.
We had quite a wide-ranging conversation with Anne during our time at Tate St Ives, and what became apparent was how important supporting women artists had been throughout Anne's career, before Tate St. Ives, she was at a non-profit in New York, a non-profit arts organisation in New York. And again, she had supported emerging women artists, late career women artists. But also, Sarah, she talks about another point in an artist's career where it's crucial to support them.
Yeah, well, she pinpoints this kind of mid-career moment when it's absolutely fundamental for artists to have some support to maintain a career. It's all well and good supporting emerging new artists. They obviously need help then when coming out of art school. But what happens kind of 10, 15, even 20 years into someone's career? And that's often when they need that extra lift, those exhibitions to really get their name even better known and just make a career as an artist feasible.
So during our conversation with Anne, we actually asked her explicitly about the gender issue. So we talked about what are the obstacles to A, pursuing a career as an artist, but B, more pertinently, are there still obstacles as a woman to pursuing a career?
I think it's a really, it's still perhaps unfortunately a pertinent question. If you look back, and probably there are going to be many generalisations here to address the question, but broadly speaking, if you look at the history of modernism and the prominence that artists received, Hepworth, I think, is an exception because she was well known in her lifetime, although she might have faced struggles at various points. It, you know, the history of British modernism is a lot about male sculptors. It still is. But I think now perhaps the focus in redressing that balance is still really important to do. So looking at particularly women working in modernism, whether sculpture or otherwise, and making sure that you continue to support their work, I think is really important, or revisit their work if it's a more historic piece. With women contemporary artists working today, I think those challenges still continue, you know, how to balance work, life, family. I think they're kind of age-old concerns, and you know, it also depends on where you live in the world, what kind of societal support you receive. Certain countries are more supportive to women generally, and so that makes it a bit easier for female artists to take the time to do both. But there was an interesting panel recently where the subject was spoken about overtly, about what is it like to be a mother and a female artist working today. That received so many comments on Facebook and so many kind of retorts of, at last someone's talking about this. I think it's still quite, it's not unspoken because we all speak about it in the field, but mostly when we get together, it's not necessarily something on a public stage. So I was really, really glad to see that actually put out there. But that does speak to the fact that these are still concerns among contemporary female artists, that they still feel that there's a pressure, or that in some cases will it damage their ability to have a really fulfilling professional career. I mean, there are many artists that I've seen who do manage both and are doing really well, but I think for others it remains a struggle depending on their contexts. I think it's just important if you're a museum or an arts organisation or a small non-profit to just be mindful of the fact that, you know, people have a lifelong career, and it's important to support people early on. But it's often in that mid-period, that kind of midlife moment, I think, that many artists feel that they're between two stages of their life. They're neither emerging anymore, nor are they incredibly established, and nor perhaps are they old enough yet to have a lifelong retrospective, which almost implies they're at the end of their career. But it's that middle, like a couple of middle decades, that are often particularly challenging, actually for both men and women, but I think more traditionally for women.
When we spoke to Rana, she was really open and frank about the impact that being a woman has had on her career, but also the myriad roles and responsibilities that also impact the amount of time she has available to pursue her career. In particular, she's got two kids, hasn't she?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the politics of being a parent and running a full-time business as an artist is something that she has been part of a conversation that has opened up in the art world recently, which is not just about specific personal biographies, but is about the wider infrastructural issues, about how artists can do these things and can sustain careers, and how particularly this has an impact on women.
And the reason I guess I'm speaking out a bit more is probably because of kind of those kind of frustration, but also because I've had people call me, I've had people message me even on Instagram. And I realise more and more actually how important it is to kind of help support other artists that are struggling, that want to you know, want to have children but also want to have a career as well. And actually, you know, why shouldn't we have both? Mm. Why do we have to choose one or the other? You know, and that's not the same for men. And so I don't know why. I mean, I remember growing up as a child and just wanting there to be no differences between myself and my brothers. I was like, well, if they're not in the kitchen washing their plate, why should I be in there washing my plate if they're not in the kitchen cooking?
Yeah.
And, you know, my father really struggled because I, this is one of the reasons why I didn't want to learn to cook. I said, the minute I knew that if I learned to cook, I would have to be in the kitchen cooking five different curries a day. And so I made a conscious decision, and I remember telling both of my parents that, no, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in being in the kitchen.
So you had a sense of injustice.
Yeah. I said, you know, if you can, you know, if I have to do the same, then it means the boys in the family have to do the same. So that was quite interesting, and it took a while for my father to kind of accept. And it's quite funny, you know, how he's like, yeah, my daughter doesn't know how to cook. She doesn't want to be in the kitchen. But yeah, I mean, for me, I realised that it is difficult. It's not easy. Mm. And especially if you're having to kind of compete with men that have, you know, 24/7 to be able to focus on their career. But, you know, everyone moves at a different pace and everyone has their own ways. But I don't believe that I need to choose one or the other. I'm learning how to kind of be firm about my opinion without needing to scream and shout about it. And I, you know, there is a stage where, last year it just got really intense, and you know, I had a mother, you know, at school say to me, well, you know, if you're freelance you should be able to, you know, go on all these school trips. And I just lost it because I was like, well, you know, there's a reason, you know, I'm freelance. It's just that I have to work at the hours that I have. And you know, and I'm strict with the, you know, the minute I pick up the kids, I try not to open any emails or have any work communication. But I can't have that if I then have to take time out to work hours. So, that is never going to happen again at school after my massive outburst. But It's surprising because sometimes it is actually women that put that kind of pressure on other women. And it's really sad because you'd think they would get you. Mm. I feel like, you know, more and more people are, you know, conscious of kind of, you know, they don't want to choose. They don't, you know, they want to be able to kind of have everything that is there.
Yeah. And another thing which is probably quite personal as well is you sort of, I think, increasingly have talked about your background and thinking about issues about racism in the UK and growing up, and whether, again, you've come to a point in your career where you feel you can actually address some of those, like the kind of more personal issues about identity and the politics of Britishness and coming to Britain, and whether you feel
it's quite a lot,
how you address that, or whether you do you ever get frustrated that sometimes biography kind of bumps into your work, or do you feel that it is actually kind of part of the process?
I think, I mean, I don't know, I like to think that I'm just incredibly fortunate that I grew up with two different cultures. And just really lucky that my father was able to bring me up, bring me over to the UK. And, you know, he didn't have an easy childhood. He had a really, really tough childhood. Both of his parents died when he was really young, so he was left responsible to take care of his younger sister. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of things. And, you know, and I think, I don't know, I mean, I don't blame my parents in terms of the difficulty I've had to face. either at school or kind of getting a job or anything like that, because, you know, they've had to deal with things themselves. And yeah, I think racism was living in East London in Hackney. I feel like I am almost living in a bubble. I don't really, you know, you don't realise how bad it is until you kind of step out of Hackney and you think, oh my God, you remember your skin colour.
Right.
You remember you're made to kind of remember your skin colour, you're made to remember your gender, you're made to remember your religion.
Mm.
You know, all of those things you take for granted when you're living in a place like this. And I think this is one of the things I was so kind of proud of living and working in the UK before the whole Brexit thing. And it's been quite upsetting. And obviously, you know, I mean, when the whole Brexit thing happened, it was really, I mean, I just cried.
Yeah.
And you don't, yeah. You don't realise the impact it had, and immediately it took me back to when we first arrived, you know, in the UK, and we got put on a street where there was loads of other Asian families living there, and you know, so they tend to kind of just put you all, you know, in the same kind of area, and so it's not easy. Just integrating. It brought that back. It brought back the fact that, you know, we had our window broken, you know, spat at, you know, shouted at, all of that kind of stuff. And I knew that it was exactly that, that it was happening all over again. And I think, I don't know, I mean, I just feel like there's everyone goes through all sorts of things, and it makes them who they are. And I think it definitely affects people.
Do you think it? Do you think your work as well responds to like the current climate? You know, is it the responsibility of artworks to somehow position themselves in relationship to what's happening in the world?
I think if you can, and if your work does, then that's amazing. And I don't really know if, you know, politically, if my work has any kind of, I don't know, correlation. But what I've really realised over the years is that it's made me, having been through what I've been through, it's made me more how do I find it? Move towards more kind of minimalism or abstraction, because again, you know, there is just so much division, you know, so much about kind of borders and you know, putting up walls, that I wanted a language that was kind of that was universal, that it didn't dictate anything, it didn't segregate anyone. So I found myself, and that's something I haven't spoken about before actually, and it's only, you know, that your questions kind of just made me think about, actually I remember thinking that, you know, this is the direction I want to go. I don't want to use a language that really segregates people. I don't want to use a language that makes them think about gender, if they're looking at a female artist or a male artist. You know, I think these are, yeah, I guess that's kind of my way of almost fighting in a way.
Yeah, but that has its own politics, yeah. Doesn't it? And maybe as well as something, I don't know, that your work is... it can give people, I don't know, a place of solace, you know, where, because it's about your physical interaction with it and your psychological interaction with it, but it's not dictating you know, it's not representational, so you've got to kind of find your own position in relationship to it. So,
yeah.
And that is perhaps, you know, something that offers people, I don't know, a different way of being or a different place in the world.
Yeah, and I think also the fact that, you know, the works doesn't have any titles. I don't really like to have any labels next to it. So it really kind of is open for the viewer to kind of interpret it. Or experience it.
Sometimes a problem in the art world is that we love to pigeonhole people and we love to ascribe certain motives or look into people's backgrounds to deduce inspiration or to find out a little bit more about them. Rana resists being pigeonholed. So Rana resists people looking for interpretation into the work by talking about her race, her religion, her background. Mm. And actually, Sarah, you had a very interesting conversation with the curator about precisely those issues, didn't you?
Yeah, Hamad Nasser and I, who he's a senior research fellow here at the Paul Mellon Centre, and he's also curating the next British Art Show 9. And he was really perceptive about the way in which Rana has used and intersected with Islamic culture, and particularly her use of abstract form as well. So we opened up that conversation and talked more about biography, Britishness and identity.
Perhaps it's, you know, artists have to be really guarded and careful as to even how they articulate their practice in terms of not trying to be, you know, not to being pigeonholed or not to be reduced to particular frames, mm-hmm. but as you know, Rana's practice has grown in maturity, as her work has circulated, as she's won prizes and done shows, perhaps there's a growing confidence that comes with that, that allows you to claim your multiple selves.
And do you think that's partly getting older, that there is a bit of distance, or you've got a longer perspective on your own history and your family's history, and especially for Rana, her family's history of coming to Britain and the processing some of those experiences of moving to Hertfordshire, you know, in the southeast of England, whether it's something about that kind of, yeah, maybe an emotional as well as an artistic maturity that allows you to look backwards a bit more.
Perhaps. I mean, one of the things, a few years ago, I served as a jury member for the V&A's Jameel Prize. Mm-hmm. And for those, you know, who don't know it, this is a prize that's given, I think, every other year for art and design that's inspired by Islamic cultures, you know, or Islamic art and design. And what struck me as really interesting was the kinds of artists who were presenting their work and claiming that lineage and heritage, including people like Rashid Araim or Chebdet Erek. So you know, people who have histories and a presence in the contemporary art world, you know, who've shown at Documenta or at Venice, and Rashid Araim's work, who've gone out of their way to distance themselves from particular sort of Islamist readings of structures, who have done sort of, you know, who are now coming back and saying, no, or Wael Shoki, you know, for instance, who are then claiming their work to say, no, we can be contemporary and, you know, Muslim or claim that sort of that link to Islamic culture. And to me, it felt like, or maybe that's just my most hopeful reading of it,
is
it feels like, okay, these are artists, perhaps, yes, I'm sure there are personal factors at play, but I think there's also a collectivity about wanting to claim a space, you know, in saying that the universal is not just, you know, the cookie-cutter modern that, you know, people fit on, is that there are ways to expand that universal set.
Yeah. And do you think that's kind of a political act? Because obviously in our wider society, wider culture, Islamophobia is on the rise. You know, we hear kind of almost daily incidents of racism. And so these kind of perhaps a more collective strategy of speaking out, a claiming of one's history is also an act of politics, of saying we are here in Britain, this is our work that we're doing, and we belong to this history as well. Could you read it that way?
I certainly think you could read it. I would sort of resist the temptation to fly the flag in that way, but in the last couple of years, particularly while it was leading the Stuart Hall Foundation and coming across young artists, activists, and you know, quite often they don't see much of a distinction. Mm. I see a much more sort of claiming of space and wanting to project a kind of, you know, identity that perhaps would have come across as old fashioned a few years ago. So I do think that claiming the different lineages, of saying that no, you can rejecting the tyranny of the or, you know, and claiming an and, I think is a political act.
Mm. And then it's interesting to think in the context of Rana's work, what, you know, a very kind of abstract geometrical practice can do in that. It's not kind of, you know, obviously depicting stories or obviously representing Islamic ideas or, yep, Muslim ideas. It's so much more nuanced and complicated than that, isn't it? And this work of abstraction and the role it has to play in the world, and perhaps opening up interpretation, as you say, that the viewer comes to it and you have to make your own relationship with each work in a way.
No, very much so. And I think also, Rana's work is also slippery in the sense that it plays with languages, but also materials from the design world, from, you know, industrial road building. So you can think about that also from a utilitarian angle of, you know, things like how do you use reflectors under bridges, or how do you use road signage, or or even furniture. So, you know, she's somebody who doesn't sort of respect those divisions of or those hierarchies of design, of fine art. She doesn't give them so much reverence.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite really interesting.
Absolutely. We spoke about with her that it's sort of, this is a podcast about sculptors.
Yeah.
And we're sort of claiming her as a woman sculptor.
Yeah.
But there's again a kind of a productive misfit in a way that she works across. You know, she's spray painting sometimes. Yeah. She's using neon at others, and just thinking how useful categories like sculpture can be at certain moments, and then increasingly, especially I think for contemporary artists, whether that just breaks down and you know, becomes kind of almost irrelevant.
Well, I mean, categories are useful to sort of frame meaning, you know? But they're most useful when you sort of break them.
Rana has had a lot of public commissions recently. She has done a major installation in King's Cross. She's got one in Oxford. And she was also selected in 2018 for the Frieze Sculpture Presentation, which is a free presentation of sculpture in the public realm in Regent's Park, which is open every summer. Frieze Sculpture is selected by Claire Lilly. Claire is very involved in the sculpture landscape in the UK. She's director of programming at Yorkshire Sculpture Park. So Sarah and I went to visit her and asked her specifically about the bigger picture, about representation, about women, about sculpture and sculpture in the public realm.
You're hugely involved in the sculptural landscape in the UK generally, and you are also selected for Frieze Sculpture.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you select for that? Is gender an issue for you, that, or is it purely based on the work?
It really is an issue because it's so hard to get a significant number of women into it. Last year we went all out to get 50-50.
Yeah. And did you measure?
No, we nearly did, and then a couple dropped out, and that's so frustrating. So I ended up with, it was just over 40% women. So I think the other element here is galleries just not investing in women. And, you know, galleries invest in people who make the money. Mm-hmm. And if you look at who's selling in the world, it's not women.
Not women sculptors.
It's not selling at really high prices.
That speaks very loudly that this is still an issue, isn't it? Because sometimes, you know, people have asked us, why are we doing this podcast? Does it even matter anymore? It's the 21st century. Mm. If we're looking at those hard facts and lists and the data, I mean, it does matter. That's kind of shocking.
So it's all part of the process. So you can't separate the commercial aspect from the institutional side at all in terms of the visibility of women.
Absolutely not. And, you know, this and it's in Frieze, it's really stark because it is all about money.
Yeah.
Well, it's about reputation and a number of other things as well. But if I say to, this has happened to me countless times, and I say, you know, can we do this? Can't do it, Claire. And then you ask about a male artist, and they go, oh, yeah, we can figure that out, and they'll fabricate something really quickly.
Yeah.
Quite significant in 3-4 months.
Yeah. And this all obviously has an impact on then what feeds the national collection and public collections, isn't it? That it's these decisions have, there's a food chain at who gets represented within collections which are meant to represent the nation as well, and we're still talking about the imbalance there about how many women artists are on show and how many women are into the collections, and it's these decisions that have an impact on that. And I think it's really interesting that it's still such a significant issue in 2019-20.
Rana is the last artist that we've chosen for our series on women sculptors, and it's interesting to think about that idea of sculptors and sculpting, particularly in relation to Rana, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, and what Hamad said about breaking categories, that they're the most useful when you break them, when you disturb them. And I hope that's what we've done here in these episodes, is not kind of essentialise or protect any of the categories, sculpture, sculptors, women, that we've used, but we have tested them and seen what the kind of challenges, what the pressure points are as
and also presented different artists who have experienced very different careers.
Yeah, huge generational differences. We're talking about someone like Barbara Hepworth, born in 1903, to Rana Begum, born in 1977. I mean, the experiences are not going to be the same, are they?
No, but also in terms of just the different reputations that they have, different career arcs. So comparing someone like Kim Lim to someone like Elizabeth Frink, who obviously got her success really early on. And then now Kim Lim posthumously is getting huge academic and intellectual recognition.
Mm, yeah, so seeing those changing fortunes, seeing how art history, like all history, is constantly being rewritten and is not a linear trajectory, is something that is open for debate, that is something that we can all intervene in rethinking.
And I really hope there's more women yet to discover within the narrative.
I do hope so. I know so. Mm. And, maybe we have to do episode 2.
For next time, Sarah. Thank you very much for joining us on Sculpting Lives. Huge thanks go to our contributors for this episode, the artist Rana Begum, curator Hamad Nasser, and the director of Tate St. Ives, Anne Barlow.
We also want to thank all the artists and contributors to the Sculpting Lives podcast. And in particular, we want to thank Isabel Mooney for research support, Claire Lynch, our producer, Kathy Courtney and colleagues at the Artist Life Project at the British Museum. And for support and sponsorship, enormous thanks go to the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art.
You can keep up to date with all our Sculpting Lives news on our Instagram page, which is @sculptinglives. Thank you for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.